We're focused on addressing complex neurodegenerative diseases. These are diseases that have devastating effects on patients, the caregivers, and society at large, honestly.
Hello, and welcome to episode 53 of the MedTech Podcast. You join me, your host, Karandeep Singh Badwell. And on this episode, we have Aaron Swaminathan, Chief Business Officer of Coya Therapeutics, a company with a focus on advancing proprietary novel therapies that aim to improve the function of regulatory T cells. Aaron began his career in clinical development and commercial roles of increasing responsibility at Bristol-Myers Squibb and Covance. He has over 20 years of hands-on healthcare business executive experience with an emphasis on corporate and business development, strategy, and finance. In this episode, we delve into the paramount importance of prioritizing patients amid physician shortages in the US healthcare system, the cutting-edge approach of targeting regulatory T cells to combat neurodegenerative diseases effectively, the pivotal role of biomarkers in diagnosing these conditions, together with the potential of combining them with physician tests, cognitive assessments, and advanced scans for a truly ideal approach, alongside how the intricacies of the human body remain a profound challenge, and that there is still an abundance of knowledge to unravel and discover. Welcome to the show, Aaron. How are you today?
I'm very good, Karandeep, and thank you for having me on the show.
It's a pleasure having you on. So first question I got for you is, how would you define an excellent healthcare provider?
Yeah. To me, an excellent healthcare provider is somebody who puts the patient at the center of everything they do. And I think once you keep the patient at the center of everything you do, then excellence follows. Whether you're an individual healthcare provider, like a doctor, a nurse, an organization, I think that principle should be the North Star, right? As long as your patient is the North Star, I think that is who an excellent provider is. It should be all about the patient at the end.
So another issue that we're having, of course, when it comes to healthcare providers is the problem of physician shortages. Why would you say this is the case, and what can we start doing to maybe address that problem?
No, so again, I don't claim to be an expert on the physician shortage, but I think at least I can speak on behalf of the United States and maybe some of Europe. Is I have friends who are physicians, and what I hear consistently from a lot of them, and which may be what is driving younger people from not choosing it as a profession, is the complexity of the administrative stuff that physicians have to do, and where, to your point of excellence, where their focus on the patient gets distracted. And I think we need to solve that problem as a society to get physicians to spend the majority of their time on the patients and not on tasks that may be distracting them from actual patient care.
So yeah, following on from that, basically, I've heard that the US healthcare system is ranked as the worst amongst high-income nations. Why would you say this is the case?
Karandeep, this is an interesting question. Again, you know, I want to make sure that I give my perspective. One, I come from a really one-sided background on this industry, right? I've been focused all my career on bringing novel therapies to patients. So I would say that the U.S. actually is pretty high in rank in terms of innovations coming out of the United States, right? And that is something to keep in mind. I think when it comes to some of these rankings, now I don't know the nuances of every variable that somebody is asking when it comes to these rankings. Part of it, I think, is the complexity of the U.S. medical system or the healthcare system. There's a lot of people involved, a lot of organizations involved, healthcare physicians, government, private insurers. And I think this complexity results in this perception and probably some truth to it that the ranking, that the United States tends to rank low. I think it is very hard. I'm not an expert on comparing other countries' healthcare systems to the US. But, you know, some of it is also perceptions around single-payer systems, right? I think a lot of people believe that the solution to healthcare is single-payer systems. Now, I'm not sure if that is entirely true. Again, you know, my knowledge on how other countries work is limited. But I think a lot of these drives that rankings that you see of the U.S. healthcare system, including the cost per patient for healthcare in the U.S. is probably higher than most other countries. And people are benchmarking these things and saying, hey, the U.S. healthcare system is not perfect. And I do think that no system is perfect. And the complexity of the U.S. healthcare system is where I believe there are some great opportunities to increase the efficiency of our healthcare system.
So just like me, you studied pharmaceutical sciences at university. How exactly did you get in the position that you're in today?
That's a great question. I think part of it is both my parents have advanced degrees in biological sciences. So I had exposure to biology, chemistry from a pretty early age. My dad took me to labs. My mom was an exceptionally good biology teacher. And I think somewhere subconsciously, all this influenced my choice. You know, like any teenager, when I had to choose the major, I dabbled with ideas of should I do liberal arts, should I go into economics. But eventually, I ended up majoring in pharmacy and then went on to get a PhD in pharmaceutical sciences. And I think it just naturally gravitated to that. I had this curiosity even as a young kid. On the fascination with how the human body works and what drives diseases, what causes diseases. And I think all that kind of naturally led me down this path.
Are there any particular interesting projects that you're working on that you're willing to discuss with the audience?
Yeah, I think we're working on some great things. Right now, I am the chief business officer at a company called Coya Therapeutics. And I joined because Coya is doing some really exciting things, and I wanted to be part of that, and that's partly why I'm here. You know, Coya, we're focused on addressing complex neurodegenerative diseases. These are diseases that have devastating effects on patients, the caregivers, and society at large, honestly, because the impact on society of some of these diseases like Alzheimer's, ALS, also known as Lou Gehrig's disease, are devastating. So that is an interesting thing we're working on, is we're looking at how do we bring new therapies to address these complicated diseases. And we're doing that by focusing on the fundamentals of the science. There are these things called the regulatory T cells, known as Tregs. That really drive a lot of inflammation. And neurodegenerative diseases are driven by inflammation in the neurons. So when the neurons get exposed to inflammation, they start, the healthy neurons or the nerve cells start getting sick, they die. And this kind of drives a lot of the neurodegenerative diseases. If it's the motor neuron, ALS, for example, or with the pyramidal neurons in Alzheimer's disease. So at Coya, we are extremely focused on developing new drugs that can restore this balance of the functional Tregs. Basically, make the good Tregs increased and the bad Tregs suppressed. And by doing this, we believe we can really address these diseases. And what is exciting is that our early clinical data we're seeing shows tremendous promise that our strategy is working.
So for the listeners today who may not understand what T cells are, would you be able to please describe what the function of a T cell is in the human body?
Well, yeah, sure. Of course, you know, T cells themselves have a lot of functions, but they're basically, in a simplistic way, they're immune cells. What they do, you know, when you have a foreign thing enter your body, everybody understands immunity. These are the T cells that are mobilized. These are cells that are mobilized to go and defend against the invader, correct? So the regulatory T cells are a kind of T cells that are focused more on regulating inflammation. So what happens when the regulatory T cells are dysfunctional is that pro-inflammatory cells start developing more, leading to inflammation. And when you have the opposite, which is when you have the Treg function improved and the Treg numbers increase, then you see a decrease in inflammation. So that is essentially, these are immune cells whose job is to protect the body. I mean, that's a simple way of saying it, I guess.
So on the topic of inflammation, what would you say are some of the lesser known causes? Of course, it could be a bad diet and stress, etc. But what would you say are some of the lesser known causes of inflammation that people perhaps don't know about?
What I want to focus on is people don't associate inflammation. People associate inflammation with swelling of the hands and some of these acute inflammations that happen, which is true, and those are inflammations as well. I think what a lot of people don't recognize is the cellular level of inflammation. That's not something that intuitively people think about. And when you think about inflammation in the context of neurodegenerative diseases, it's not something people intuitively think about, right? This is inflammation at the cellular level that we're talking about. And the drivers of that are a lot of different things, you know. Of course, the general inflammation is driven by things like diet and genetics and so on. But the neurodegenerative inflammation has some genetic component to it. But, you know, a lot of the science is still not fully characterized. But what we do know is that inflammation at the cellular level drives a lot of these complex diseases.
So on the topic of inflammation, how exactly would you know that you have inflammation at a cellular level? Is this something that needs to be diagnosed by a doctor? Are there symptoms? How would somebody know that this is happening?
So there's a lot of blood biomarkers, oxidative stress markers, for example, OxLDL, some of the interleukins, some of the cytokines, some of the chemokines. There's very good correlation that some of these are increased in patients that are showing are in an inflammatory state. So there's some very good data we ourselves have generated, but there is data historically that shows a direct correlation between some of these oxidative stress markers and diseases such as ALS, for example, or some of the chemokines and cytokines and Alzheimer's, for example. Alzheimer's patients show increased levels of TNF-alpha expression, IL-6, these are all cytokines that are increased, and you also see, so there are definitely markers in the blood, in the cerebrospinal fluid, and of course you can also do brain imaging in the case of neurodegenerative diseases to look at inflammation in the brain.
So would a basic blood test show some of these biomarkers, or do you think that there needs to be a high level of testing to be sure?
I think neurodegenerative diseases are complex, so biomarkers, blood biomarkers definitely are important in being able to diagnose. I think they have a big role to play in whether a therapy is working and the predictiveness of if a therapy is going to work when you look at these biomarkers. So I do believe they're extremely important, but at the end, you know, diagnosis and management has to be a combination of things. It's got to be biomarkers, there's the physician tests, there are the cognitive tests that go with neurodegenerative diseases that are important to be able to clinically assess how a patient is doing, and scans as well, including like PET scans. So I think a combination of all of that is the right way to approach neurodegenerative diseases. But we are excited about the potential of biomarkers to be predictive of therapeutic efficacy in these patients.
So since working in this industry, what have you learned about the human body that you would say is perhaps not so much common knowledge?
What have I learned? I mean, I think what I've learned is I barely scratched the surface of the human body, right? And I'm speaking as an individual, but I think I can collectively speak for humanity that we barely understand how the human body functions. And it is something that is, what I've learned is the human body is complex, but at the end of it, it is at the very cellular level. The human body is a composition of millions of cells. And you can almost drive everything down to the cellular level and start addressing diseases. What is fascinating for me is the advances that science has made in understanding what drives some of these complicated diseases, right? Especially when we talk about diseases like cancer and neurodegenerative degenerative diseases, they don't have one single cause. You can't put your finger on one thing and say, this causes this disease. Unlike a viral infection, you know, you can point your finger at a specific virus and say, this caused the disease. And therefore, if I remove and eliminate this virus, the disease should be eliminated. It gets more complicated when you're talking about neurodegenerative diseases, metabolic diseases, cancer. And I think that I find is fascinating about the human body and the redundancies that are there in the human body.
So if somebody wants to learn more in this field, are there any particular resources or places that you would send them to?
Yeah, of course. I mean, you know, there is a lot of books written on, for example, I think a good book that I recently read is a book written by an author called Siddharth Mukherjee. It's called Song of the Cell. You know, I think that's a book that is an excellent read for anybody who's trying to just understand how the human body works and how at the basic cellular level things work and how much. Since the discovery of cells, I think the author talks about the discovery of cells in the 17th century to today, how we're looking at cellular therapy, we're looking at altering things at the cellular level. I think books like that would be a good starting point. And of course, depending on the backgrounds of people, you can get very deep into some of the technical books as well. There are great resources like podcasts, such as the podcast we're just doing today with you, that are great resources for people to quickly learn about new areas that they may not be as familiar with.
Another topic I want to discuss with you is, of course, the placebo effect. Have you ever seen any miraculous recoveries in your work over the years when it comes to placebo?
I have not, but I know I've definitely anecdotally heard stories where placebo effects have been pretty compelling. And it is not, I mean, that is exactly why we do placebo-controlled trials, right? I mean, that's exactly why the FDA and the European agencies, a lot of them want to see well-designed controlled trials, just to make sure that the drug's effect is normalized and that we are taking into account any placebo effect. So most of the drugs that are approved in the market today have done studies against the placebo or some kind of control where the drug was not given exactly for that purpose, because especially in certain diseases, the placebo effect is there, and people have seen that the mind can will its way into certain things. And if you believe that something is working, sometimes it does. So, yeah, but I myself haven't seen any miraculous examples, though. So,
as Chief Business Officer at Coira Therapeutics, what exactly does your work involve? What do you do day to day?
Yeah, well, I mean, as my title implies, my primary focus at Coira is to enable bringing our new therapies ultimately to the patients. As we discussed before, ultimately everything we do is about the patients and getting it to them. But sometimes the most effective and efficient way to bring these products to the patients is through strategic partnerships. Partnerships with bigger pharmaceutical companies or partnerships with other equally interested companies, complementary partnerships. So a lot of my focus is on enabling those types of partnerships. Those partnerships do two things. One, of course, they bring these products to the market faster because the power of two or three is better than the power of one. The brains come together. It also allows a small company like Coira to raise money in a non-dilutive fashion, which also helps from a business perspective, helps our shareholders because they then have a better return on their investment, while at the same time we are achieving the end goal, which is to bring these drugs faster to patients. So a lot of my time is spent on focusing on these external partnerships and also developing the strategies along with Howard Berman, our CEO, on where the company should kind of prioritize and focus and those types of things.
So as far as I'm aware, Coira Therapeutics is listed on NASDAQ. How exactly does a company go about getting onto NASDAQ, and are there reasons of why a company should do that, or maybe why they shouldn't go onto NASDAQ?
I mean, I think the question is, should a company, NASDAQ is one of the ways you go public in the United States. The other is the New York Stock Exchange. We chose NASDAQ because NASDAQ, as you know, is where most of the biotech or technology type companies are listed. NASDAQ was formed initially to support tech listings. So the biotech fits naturally into the NASDAQ platform, and that's where we're listed. Why a company should go public really depends on the strategic problems each company is trying to solve. In our case, we went public in an extremely difficult public market. When Coya went public, it was one of the very few companies that actually successfully IPO'd last year. So it was a tremendous effort by the Coya team, none of which I can take credit for. And the reason to go public is you raise money, right? Companies go public to raise money to advance the products they have. It's just one of the levers you use to raise money. You don't have to go public. A lot of companies choose to stay private and raise money. We chose the path of the public to be able to kind of raise the money needed to move our programs forward and listed ourselves on the NASDAQ exchange.
So when a company goes public, do you feel as though it's a form of advertisement, or do you feel as though that's not really the case? As in, when a company goes public, do you find that it helps increase the brand name? So you can be used as like a marketing strategy, would you say?
Question, Karandeep. I think that may be a byproduct of going public. You're right. Though that is never the intent of why a company goes public. At least that wasn't the intent why Coya went public. You go public because it is one of the mechanisms through which you raise money, and then it opens you to the public market in terms of being able to raise money, which you can't do as a private company. So it has its pros and cons, obviously. But being public definitely puts you more under a microscope, more under the spotlight. So in that sense, you do indirectly get more exposure for a company when you're public, because being public comes with a lot of accountability, a lot of SEC regulations. We have to report every quarter. We have to report what we're doing publicly. So there's definitely more news flow that comes out of public companies because of some of the regulatory requirements as well, which automatically drives probably an increased awareness of these companies. So
you're currently operating in the US. Are there any jurisdictions around the world that you're currently targeting or planning on targeting in the future?
We are based in the US, but our products are obviously applicable globally. So that kind of comes back to our conversation on my role. Part of my role is I don't think at this point Coya wants to build infrastructure in other countries, right? We want to be focused. We want to be very fiscally responsible in how we use the money we have raised to move our products forward. And that is exactly where partnership opportunities come in. Working with strategic partners who have the expertise in Europe, for example, would be probably the right way for us to advance some of those. So we expand our footprint globally, not by necessarily building that infrastructure ourselves, but with partnering with companies that already have that infrastructure to be able to commercialize the products in those regions, to be able to understand the regulatory environment in those markets. So I think that is the likely approach we will take at Coya, and that is part of my job function here as well, is to find those right partners to be able to take our therapies outside the US as well.
How exactly did Coya Therapeutics come to be? Where did the idea start from, and how did it get to where it is today?
Yeah,
can you please share with us the story?
Yeah, definitely. No, this predates me. So, you know, the best person to tell the story would be our co-founder and CEO, Howard Berman, because the story starts with him. It's a very personal story for Howard, actually. Howard's dad began showing signs of dementia and very progressive dementia many years ago. Sadly, Howard's dad passed away a few months ago, but Howard had taken his dad to the Houston Methodist Hospital to meet a probably the top doctor in neurodegenerative diseases in the country, Dr. Stanley Appel. So as Howard was talking about his dad to Dr. Appel, I think one thing led to the other, and they talked about the science. Howard was super excited by the compelling data that was coming out of Dr. Appel's lab to address neurodegenerative diseases, including ALS and Alzheimer's, and that led to the formation of the company. I think Howard is a very entrepreneurial person with a PhD as well and strong leadership experience in big pharma companies, and they joined forces and decided to start Coya. So I think that is the evolution of Coya. It predates me, but it's a very powerful story. And some of the early people that joined Coya are also personally motivated because either they themselves directly or close family members are affected by some of these devastating neurodegenerative diseases. So it's a very personal story.
So if we were to go back a few years and talk to the younger Aaron, what was his ambitions out of university? What was the younger Aaron planning on doing?
So the younger Aaron initially wanted to be a pilot, so, you know, like a lot of kids. So obviously didn't do that. But I think the younger Aaron is doing what he wanted to do in a funny way. I don't think he realized it then, but what I wanted to always do was to help create things, help bring things that are interesting and make them meaningful, like meaning taking good science or taking good ideas and making them real. That was kind of always for me a passion, and I think I'm kind of living it right now in these roles where I get to take good ideas, get to take good science, work done by brilliant people, not by me, but being able to kind of shepherd them and bring them to be real, to actually make a meaningful difference in society and people's life. And I think that was what my goals were as a young person. And I believe I'm getting a step closer to that every day in my career. And it's been a very satisfying journey for me, honestly. But like every kid, I had a lot of interesting things that I wanted to do. But you know, I'm glad I chose the path I chose. So.
Interesting you mentioned pilot. I was in the Royal Air Force Cadets for 5 years, and my ambitions was to be a pilot. But then I was at the age of where it was going to be university or go full-time into the Air Force, and then I decided to pick university, and I think it worked out for me in the end.
Yeah, no, I think we all make some choices, and it's been a fun ride for me. I've absolutely enjoyed this journey.
So working with a relatively young company, I'm guessing, takes up a lot of your time. But Aaron, what exactly do you do outside of work when you have some free time?
Yeah, so working at a fast-paced company like Coya, work is constantly on. We are not a traditional company in the sense that we work 9 to 5, you know, to us, every minute matters, every day matters. So I do spend a lot of my time and energy on advancing Coya. And I don't find it to be a difficult thing because it's actually enjoyable. It's almost is part of my hobby is to drive growth here. But outside of what I do with Coya, I love reading books. I like to dabble in golf. I do not claim to be a good golfer by any stretch, but any opportunity I can get to go out there, hit some balls and play some golf, I love to do that because I find golf to be pretty therapeutic. It kind of is that three to four hours of golf is a time where I'm able to truly disconnect from everything else and kind of focus on the golf, and you're outdoors, so that's something I do. My wife and I love to travel, though we haven't done much of it lately, and see different countries, different places. We also love to eat, so we go try different cuisines. I'm fortunate to live in Manhattan, a city where You can find food from any country within probably 20 minutes of where we are. So we do love to do those kinds of things.
Aaron, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on the show. What one piece of advice would you be leaving the listeners with today?
I think the advice I would give listeners is, you know, have a purpose. And I think purpose drives a lot of things we do in our life. And if that purpose can be something that is for the greater good of society, I think that can be the most satisfying career paths or personal paths one can find. And greater good of society doesn't have to be something grand. It can be something simple. And, you know, every little thing we do that helps the society as a whole, I think makes us at the end feel happier. So I would say to people, try and find what that is for you. I mean, it's hard for me to give a generic answer to what that is, but I think we all know it when we see it or feel it and follow that. I read an article on Harvard Business Review a while ago that says follow your calluses or follow your blisters, and I love that, because it's not really about following your passion. It's about what are the things that you love doing repeatedly because you like it and you want to get better at it. You know, follow that, and then you'll find that you probably are going to do great things there.
Thank you very much for your time, Aaron.
Thank you, Karandeep. It was a pleasure talking to you, and thank you for having me on the show.
Thank you for listening to episode 53 of the MedTech Podcast. If you have not already done so, please subscribe. If you wish to learn more about Aaron, you can connect with him online or visit his company website, the links of which are provided in the description. If there are any particular topics or guests you would like for me to have on the show in future, then please feel free to reach out.